Hi, Patrick Cox here, and on The World in Words this week, self-censorship. So today it's all about when you should keep your mouth shut and when you should talk, no matter what the consequences. We'll hear from a child victim of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. She largely kept her mouth shut about her experiences. Now she's making up for lost time. And did the first American correspondents who arrived in Hiroshima and Nagasaki also engage in self-censorship? The World in Words podcast and the World Radio program, The Big Show, they're both co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH here in Boston. For that, and to find out about all of our podcasts, go to theworld.org. You can also read further notes on this edition of the podcast at theworld.org/language, also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. Send me your feedback, your criticisms, your suggestions for further coverage at the World in Words Facebook group, or you can tweet me. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. Now, today's theme is speech, speaking freely or not. In previous pods, we've done things on free speech as permitted or curtailed by governments. But what we haven't touched on is another form of curtailment, and that's often referred to as self-censorship. It seems to me that one state of mind must be present for self-censorship, and that is fear. It might be the fear of losing a job if you speak out against your employer. It might be the fear of being sent to jail, or even worse, if you live in a country where there's little or no protection for free speech. But you don't really need an oppressive government or a dictatorial boss to practice self-censorship. You don't need any of that. All you need, in fact, is fear. It could be fear of losing face or losing money or being ostracized by family or neighbors, or simply the fear of being accused of inappropriate disclosure, TMI. See, it's not all negative. There are a ton of reasons why we don't speak freely. Well, the pod today is going to consider speech and whether we as individuals decide to use it surrounding one monumental historical event, or I should say a twin event, the American atomic bombs that were dropped on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki 65 years ago this month. They killed nearly 250,000 people directly, and many more later on, people who died from radiation sickness. First today, we're going to consider the censorship of A-bomb survivors, and then the self-censorship that American reporters may have practiced in the immediate aftermath to the A-bomb. Reporters who filed stories from Hiroshima and Nagasaki's in the weeks after the bombs were dropped. So first, the victims. Now, 5 years ago, to coincide with the 60th anniversary of the bombs, I did a series for The Big Show. The series was mainly about the mental state of A-bomb survivors. I interviewed many survivors, Japanese, Koreans, and Japanese Americans. Now, most of these survivors had gone years without being able to tell their stories. They had self-censored their life histories, and they had good reasons to, as we'll hear. But it didn't do them any good psychologically. And I'm not sure if the confessional outpouring that many of them choose to engage in close to the end of life, whether it helps, but it does seem to be a deep-seated need, for some people at least. I'll post links to the entire four-part series, which maps all of that out. But here, I'm just going to play the first part. Now, this is a fairly dramatic story and family revelation, and something of an explanation of the need to self-censor. And I should just issue a warning here. There are a couple of very disturbing descriptions in this story. Here goes. Hiroshima is a place whose reputation precedes it, overwhelms it, in fact. It's easy to forget that 60 years after the atomic bomb, this is very much a living city. Hiroshima has rebuilt itself, as so many Japanese cities have done after wars or natural disasters. This city, though, could never conceal its history behind sparkling new buildings, not without changing its name. In any case, Hiroshima deliberately makes connections with its past. The streetcars are part of that. You can still ride one of four streetcars that survived the atomic bomb, though most of the city's fleet are ultra-modern. There are other reminders of Hiroshima's past, a few half-destroyed buildings, a memorial, a museum. But many of the living reminders, the people themselves, are silent.
Akiko Naono grew up here, knowing that her aunt had lived through the atomic bomb.
She doesn't talk about her experience, and there was only one time when I was a high school student, I begged her to tell me the story. That was the only time she told me her story, but she just says she doesn't want to talk about it.
Until recently, that was also the case with Sueko Hada.
I didn't talk about it, at least not in a formal way, but I would watch the commemoration on TV with my children every August 6th, and I'd talk a bit about it then. No details, though.
On this day, Hada has agreed to meet us for an interview. She's a small, thin woman dressed in a black trouser suit. Hada has brought along her daughter, her two granddaughters, and her one-year-old great-granddaughter. The story she tells us is horrific. It contains many details that even her granddaughters didn't know before this day. In August 1945, Hadar was living with her parents and her four elder sisters in a house that was barely a half mile from the point where the bomb hit. On the morning of August 6th, her parents had already left the house to go to work. She and her sisters were eating breakfast. Suddenly, there was a flash of light, followed by a tremendous explosion. That's all Hadar remembers of the blast. She lost consciousness. When she came to, she found herself trapped under a collapsed wall. Her sisters were trapped too. Sueko Hadar was 7 years old when this happened.
Eventually, I managed to claw my way out from under the rubble. By now, our house was on fire and the cries of my sisters were getting fainter. I left to look for help. When I went outside, I saw that everything had totally changed. Although it had been a beautiful morning, it looked like twilight now. Everyone was injured, badly injured. No one was helping other people. They just looked after themselves. I myself was bleeding from a neck wound. There was blood all over the white clothes I was wearing. I wanted to return to the house, but I got lost. The landscape had totally changed. I didn't know which way to go. The only thing I could do was to follow the other injured people. Still to this day, my sisters' voices haunt me. I can hear them saying, "Please, call for help." That's the most painful thing, that I ran away from my sisters. I've felt guilty about this since that day. I'll feel guilty as long as I live. I'll never be happy.
None of Sueko Hadar's sisters survived. Hadar herself was in a daze. She was utterly unable to comprehend this new world, inhabited by frightening-looking strangers.
I didn't recognize anyone, so all I could do was follow the others. I saw terrible things. There were people with their eyeballs hanging out of their sockets. There were others whose cheeks had been ripped open from the corners of their mouths to their ears. I saw a young mother running with a headless baby on her back. I saw someone else with his belly ripped open and intestines spilling out. Most of these people looked like ghosts. It was truly a vision of hell. But pretty soon I got used to seeing these things. Everyone did.
Hadar eventually made it to a makeshift camp outside of town. She stayed there for a few days.
More and more injured people were being brought in every day. I just waited there, always hoping that my parents would come to pick me up. But then, suddenly, the refugee camp was shut down, because the military thought it would be targeted in air raids. I had nowhere to go. A soldier took pity on me, gave me some money, and told me to take the train to his grandmother's house. But on the train, a woman stole all my belongings. Then someone else offered to take me to my elementary school. There, I met one of my teachers. He'd returned to the school to look for missing students. It was the first time since the A-bomb had hit that I'd come across anyone I knew. When I saw him, I felt as if I met a Buddha in hell.
Hadar's teacher was alive, but her parents weren't. Her entire family had been wiped out by the bomb. Sueko Hadar grew up very quickly after that. She knew she was on her own. A few years after the atomic bomb struck, she decided she'd have to get married to survive.
At the time, I was being raised by relatives. It was very hard for them, especially after they had a baby. I knew they had to reduce the number of mouths to feed. Round about then, a man offered to take me as his wife. I said yes, and we got married the month I graduated from junior high.
Hadar had children, but she was often distant from them. Only rarely did she talk about what she'd been through.
Even though he was little, my son cried when I told him my story. I think he was in third grade. He cried and said, "I'm so sorry, Mom." Generally, I didn't want other people to know I was a Hiroshima orphan. It wasn't respectable to be an orphan. Also, a lot of Japanese people believed that if you'd been exposed to A-bomb radiation, you had a contagious disease. I know many other survivors who have concealed their past from friends and neighbors.
Hadar, though, no longer conceals her past. She even talks about her health problems, often the most sensitive issue for A-bomb survivors. She's had many illnesses. In 1987, doctors told her she wouldn't live 5 years. Sueko Hadar hasn't exactly come to terms with her life story, but she does want to make sense of it by retelling it. This interview is as much for the family members she's brought with her as for anyone else. Hadar's granddaughter, Yuko, is 23. Yuko says that she, like all children in Japan, learned about the A-bomb at school. But lectures in class, she says, didn't compare with hearing it direct from your own grandmother. Yuko's elder sister Yoshiko says she now feels she's inherited her grandmother's memory. Holding her one-year-old baby, she says, "It's my responsibility to pass this on to my child." The baby is named Luna, and she's a delightful surprise for the 67-year-old Hadar.
I always thought I would die in my 40s. I never imagined I would be able to see my great-grandchild.
These lighter moments are rare, and they're often followed by dark observations from Hadar. It happens several times during our interview. First contentment, then foreboding.
Today, I'm so grateful to see my family living in happiness. But I get nervous, because I was at the height of my happiness the day before the A-bomb was dropped. Our family had a meal together for the first time in 4 months. And then the next day, my life was destroyed.
There seems to be enough tragedy in Hadar's story for an entire generation. But in fact, there are tens of thousands of people from Hiroshima with similar stories. Like Hadar, they describe what they saw as a hell populated by ghosts. Like her, they're unable to feel happy. And like her, they worry that radiation is still in their bodies. Akiko Naono, the woman who coaxed a few A-bomb memories out of her aunt, has heard the stories of more than 100 survivors. She recently compiled those in a book. Naono uses the Japanese word hibakusha, which means bomb-affected people.
Every time I talk with hibakusha, I feel so painful because, in a way, they are reliving the trauma again.
But many survivors feel they have to do that now. They're concerned that their stories will die with them and that their suffering will have been for naught. So they're speaking of their experiences for the very first time.
One aged hibakusha literally told me that now I told you my story, I can die in peace.
The story told, the memory preserved. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox, Hiroshima. I'll post a picture or two of Sueko Hadar and the other family members who I met that day. I'll also post links to the other stories in that series. And let me just talk about those for a minute because they play a part in this discussion of self-censorship. One is on Koreans who really had it hard. At the time of the bombing, Korea was a part of the Japanese Empire, and there were hundreds of thousands of Koreans who lived and worked in Japan, very much as second-class citizens, third-class citizens, and Korean survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, who eventually made it back to Korea. They had even more reason not to talk about their experiences because there was an almost total ignorance about the effects of radiation, whether it was contagious or hereditary, and indeed just a general suspicion of Koreans who had spent a long time in Japan. And that Korean experience contrasts quite sharply with Japanese hibakusha who moved to the United States. I talked to some U.S.-based survivors for part three of the series, and American society's more confessional character rubbed off on some of them. They were a little more able to talk and talk among themselves. But even then, some were warned off by the Japanese expatriate establishment into talking too openly. In any case, shame and uncertainty have played their roles, along with fear, in the self-censorship of many hibakusha.
We're going to turn things around now and consider whether there was self-censorship among American reporters in the weeks after the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. Let's backtrack a little. So the U.S. dropped the bomb on Hiroshima on August 6th, 1945. The Nagasaki bomb was dropped on August 9th. 6 days later, on the 15th, Japan surrendered. World War II was over. Japan became an occupied country. The U.S. military called all the shots. And within a few weeks, American newspaper correspondents were reporting from the ground in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, this was clearly a key moment in history that reporters and editors around the world were eager to record. But it was also a time of great transition from war to peace. During the war, in many democracies, there had been military censorship. Now that the war was over, everyone knew that the censorship would be partially, eventually completely lifted. But in the meantime, it was often down to the reporters and to the editors to figure out the rules. And there was also public opinion to think about. The Japanese had been the enemy of the United States since 1941, when they attacked Pearl Harbor. For 4 years, the Japanese had been depicted as ruthless, cruel, and, well, evil. And this might well have rubbed off on the American reporters and editors confronted with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In any case, just how the bombings and their aftermath were reported is the subject of much debate to this day. Here's what we know. The U.S. military arranged for a press tour of a group of American reporters. They toured Hiroshima and Nagasaki in early September 1945, about 4 weeks after the bombs were dropped. Also, and we found out about this in just the past few years, those were not the first American reporters there. George Weller of the Chicago Daily News, he made it to Nagasaki on his own just a couple of days before the press tour went in. Most of his reports, though, did not see the light of day for decades. Not, in fact, until his son sold copies of them to a Japanese newspaper in 2005 and then collected them in a book called First Into Nagasaki. And the reason why we only recently saw those reports, according to George Weller, was that the U.S. military suppressed them. However, Japanese freelance journalist Atsuko Shigesawa, she worked in the newspaper business in Hiroshima for many years, she has published a book in Japan on the international reporting of the bombings, and she has arrived at very different conclusions about Weller's reports and about the reports of the American reporters on that press tour a couple of days later. Shigesawa believes there was censorship all round, military, yes, but also self-censorship by the reporters themselves.
I think those correspondents could have reported anything if they wanted, but they did, I think, maybe more self-censorship than the government or military censorship.
Shigesawa says newspaper editors, too, participated in the self-censorship. Remember, this was a time of victory, celebration to a degree, and of gratitude to the Americans who sacrificed their lives. So news from two vaporized Japanese cities where more people by the day were dying from radiation sickness tended to be buried on the inside pages of papers. The dispatches themselves, they were cut down.
The writing was often shortened, or the description of radiation disease cut out or denied by editorial edition of a paragraph saying, you know, scientist doesn't agree with this view, and they say maybe it's Japanese propaganda, you know, something like this.
That's very interesting. And at the same time, or briefly afterwards, were there accounts from non-American reporters, mm-hmm. from reporters from other parts of the world, that reported radiation disease differently in you know, more detail?
In this period of time, there's only one non-American reporter who covered this A-bomb, who was Wilfred Burchett for the Daily Express in London. He was an Australian, and he had this order from his newspaper, you know, get this news first. He went there by himself without any military help, and he wrote mostly about this radiation disease, saying A-bomb is still killing people there. And, you know, he also described how they are dying.
I see. So he, not only did he travel independently,
but he also focused more deeply on the effects of the dropping of the bomb on the local population.
Right, yeah. And he later accused these American correspondents, saying, you know, they never went to like hospitals and they never saw these people.
Actually, some of those American reporters did visit hospitals. George Weller wrote about a disease X that was killing people who appeared to have initially survived Nagasaki in good shape. William Lawrence of the New York Times also met with radiation victims in hospitals. But censorship, whether military or editorial, it meant that those sections of the reports weren't published. Shigesawa has seen many of the original reports, and if a newspaper shortened a reprinted report, it was usually a segment about the effect of radiation on the human body. In other cases, those depictions of radiation sickness may have been observed by reporters, but not written about until much later.
Lawrence of the New York Times, he mentions that they went to the hospital and talked to the doctors there and talked to the patients, but it was like almost 25 years later that he wrote about this. But in their articles, actual articles they published, they never mentioned about having gone to hospitals.
Right. Didn't Lawrence say something, I don't know when, that he believed that Japanese doctors were overstating the effects of radiation exposure in order to garner sympathy for the Japanese?
Yes. Yeah. He even totally declines what, you know, Japanese say or these effects of radiation in his article at that time.
So, the first draft of history, as much as we can make out, left a whole bunch out. And it's easy decades later for reporters and editors to blame official censors for all of this. It's much less easy for them, for us, to fess up and say, we didn't want to present the enemy, the former enemy, with a propaganda gift. We didn't want our country that had sacrificed so much, that had, after all, ended the war with these two atomic strikes. We didn't want the United States to take the blame for this mysterious disease that was killing so many men, women, and children, people who'd survived the original blast, but were now dying in the most gruesome ways. Self-censorship is understandable. I'm not sure if I'm any clearer about when it's a good idea to practice self-censorship and when it isn't. But it is a good idea to talk and think about it, because we do it all the time. I think I'll stop here. Post your comments on Facebook at the World in Words group page. Also, tweet me. My handle is Patrick Cox, P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X, or email me, language@pri.org. On the next pod, I think we'll have some fun.